The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. International Overdose Awareness Day was August 31st. It was the final event of Overdose Prevention Center's Solidarity Week, which runs August 25th through August 31st. Events were held around the world, many somber remembrances of loved ones, family, and friends who lost their lives to a toxic, unregulated drug supply and overdose, victims, ultimately, of the war on drugs. The drug war is yet another example of what the historian and author Barbara Tuchman called the March of Folly in her brilliant 1984 book by that same name. In it, she describes this march of folly as the pursuit of policies that are contrary to the self-interest of the state or constituency involved. To qualify as folly, the policy adopted has to meet three criteria. It must have been perceived as counterproductive in its own time, not merely by hindsight. A feasible alternative course of action must have been available. And the policy in question should be that of a group and not an individual ruler, prime minister, or president. And the policy should persist beyond any one political lifetime. Sound familiar? Another aspect of this folly is what she described as wooden-headedness, a lovely, old-fashioned term. It's more than merely stubborn. As she puts it, wooden-headedness means acting according to wish while not allowing oneself to be deflected by the facts. As another historian once said of Philip II of Spain, no experience of the failure of his policy could shake his belief in its essential excellence. Again, sounds all too familiar. Tuchman's March of Folly was published in 1984. It was only 2 years later, in 1986, that Richard Cowan, the conservative and one-time normal director, wrote a piece in the National Review in which he coined the term the Iron Law of Prohibition. Put simply, the harder the enforcement, the harder the drugs. More than a century of prohibition in this northern part of Abya Yala, now referred to colonially as the United States, has brought us into a time of novel synthetic drugs, more powerful and more dangerous than ever before, drugs like fentanyl and, more recently, nitazenes. Nitazenes, nitazenes, I've pronounced it both ways. We're about to hear it pronounced nitazenes, so we'll go with that. I've been talking about nitazenes quite a bit recently because they're showing up more and more around the world, and that's likely to continue, at least until they're edged out of the market by something even stronger. The New South Wales Users and AIDS Association is a peer-based drug user organization. NUA strives to improve advocacy for and services supporting the diversity of people impacted by stigma and discrimination caused by the criminalization of drug use across New South Wales through working with a broad range of stakeholders and partners to support systemic change. The NUA has been holding a series of very informative webinars and online presentations recently, putting out a lot of great information. On today's show, we're going to hear a portion of their recent seminar on nitazenes. Let's hear one of the speakers. Jared Brown is the Manager of Toxicity Response, Epidemiology, and Surveillance at the Centre for Alcohol and Other Drugs in the New South Wales Ministry of Health in Australia.
So nitazenes is a synthetic opioid. They're a particular class of synthetic opioid. There's more than 50 of them that have now been synthesized. They were developed back in the 1950s originally as a possible pharmaceutical, but they abandoned development of them further because they were actually found to be more likely to cause respiratory depression, so slow the breathing down, kind of causing lack of oxygen. So they weren't pursued further as a pharmaceutical, but we've seen a resurgence in recent years in terms of a development of new nitazenes in response to kind of changes around the scheduling or the kind of prohibition of the manufacture in countries such as China. So we keep seeing diversification of new nitazenes popping up. And so in Australia, we first kind of had cases detected in 2021. And with an increasing number of detections and subsequent drug warnings that have been issued since in the past year. So I guess the additional thing on this slide, kind of we can see in the bottom right corner that we've got this varying kind of strength or potency. So some of them are only kind of 5 times stronger than morphine, but then others are 1,000 times stronger than morphine. So the effects that you get at that given dose, in terms of if you take kind of 1 milligram of it, can vary kind of, as we can see here, 200-fold. So depending on which nitazine that you happen to get, and there's no way of knowing which one that you're getting without kind of analytical confirmation. The thing to understanding them, I guess, in terms of the naming, just they usually all end in nitazine. Sometimes you might see them end in nitazepine. That's a newer class of a subclass of nitazenes, but they are all kind of part of that overall family. Can go through the next slide, and that kind of just showcases the drug warnings that have gone out from across Australia. So I'm from New South Wales, so I'll speak a little bit more specifically to our New South Wales experience, but we can see here that there has been very different nitazenes detected in Australia across multiple jurisdictions. If we go to the next slide, we see in 2024 the most kind of drug warnings that have been released in time relating to nitazenes. And the concerning aspect of it is the range of products that we're finding them in. So that's a really important thing to understanding kind of the risks and the harm reduction planning. So we see it in a range of counterfeit pharmaceuticals. So we've seen it in opioids, we've seen it in benzodiazepines, and so we've got counterfeit tablets. Then we've got people who thought that they were using kind of cocaine or ketamine, various other kind of stimulant type substances that it has been detected in unknowingly. MDMA tablets that kind of look and kind of exactly like you'd expect to have an ecstasy tablet, but actually contain nitazenes earlier this year in New South Wales. We've also seen people using it through vape products, both intentionally and unintentionally, through refillable vapes, as well as kind of in people who thought that they were using heroin that ended up containing nitazenes. So that's kind of the kind of array that we've seen across Australia and within New South Wales. If we go to the next slide, I'll just briefly just touch on how within New South Wales kind of we are monitoring for nitazine, because it actually requires because of the diversity of presentations, we need a very diverse monitoring system to be able to detect them. So in New South Wales, we kind of people, deaths that are referred to the coroner, they have toxicology analysis done, and we monitor that on a routine basis. We also have a surveillance program across emergency department presentations where we get analysis of selected kind of cases that kind of are kind of particularly severe or unusual. We monitor kind of poison center calls. We monitor specifically for any mentions of nitazenes in an ED presentation that the nursing triage text takes down. We look at kind of opioid-related ED presentations to see if there's any clusters of opioid overdoses, because often or sometimes there may not be a detection of the nitazene, but a cluster of overdoses in itself is a concern. So using ambulance and ED presentation monitoring is important. We also use data from police seizures where they're analysed. We've been involved in analysing discarded syringes. That's important relating to the Penrith overdose cluster from earlier in this year, where kind of they were mostly community managed. So kind of being able to analyse discarded injecting equipment for nitazenes has been important to detect that, because otherwise they would not show up from emergency department monitoring. And wastewater is an emerging one as well, just to understand population level use. And that's something that is kind of in a novel method that's happening. And we also kind of in New South Wales monitor just direct reports, just any suspicions from a whole range of partners within kind of clinical groups, peers. Very happy to ever hear about any concerns that occur in the community to be able to follow up and verify if there is a concern relating to nitazenes. Just within New South Wales, this is our kind of collection of unfortunate collection. I don't like to collect them, but we've had 8 advisories about nitazenes within New South Wales, which 7 of which were targeted for the public and 4 for clinicians. And kind of they just talk, they're showcased here, but they signify some of the examples that I've already been through. So if we go to the next slide, it summarizes the time course of detections over time through our monitoring program. And so we can see six different nitazenes have been found within New South Wales from our kind of clinical surveillance program. This figure does not, so here we see kind of first detection in early 21 with an increasing number of detections in the last year. This does not include the Penrith opioid overdose cluster that happened several months ago. That's from that cluster, we actually have identified at least 29 discarded syringes that contain nitazenes. Five of those have been confirmed as proto-nitazene, and the others are still pending confirmation. But it shows you that there are nitazenes out there. If we go to the next slide, I'll just quickly talk through some of the kind of characteristics of those cases of those people who've unfortunately suffered overdose. So it's mostly young men who are involved in kind of these nitazene overdose presentations. Five sadly have died out of those kind of 20 case, those 20 people. We've got a mix in terms of people who are using, kind of intentionally using nitazenes or an opioid, but we've also got a number of people who had kind of no idea that they were using an opioid, and they're particularly kind of vulnerable populations as they might not have access to take-home naloxone. The route of administration we see in that kind of bottom left actually is very varied. So we've had nasal sprays, we've had people snorting it, thinking, or insufflation is snorting, thinking it was kind of cocaine. People who are inhaling is kind of the vaporized route, ingesting and swallowing and injecting. So it's actually very mixed in terms of that to understand that we really need to kind of target a broad group of people. And then the forms that it comes in is in the bottom right, that yes, it's kind of in vape refill liquids to tablets or powders. And if I finish up, oh, sorry, two more slides just to summarize. So naloxone is really, really important. So it works. There's a lot of kind of comments about kind of, or it whether kind of it, do you need massive doses or not? Most of the time, standard doses work. So that's the key message. Do go in, give it. It will work most of the time. Sometimes another dose or two may be needed, but not routinely. Just do your the standard kind of take-home naloxone messaging is absolutely appropriate to continue. In the hospital setting, though, we are finding that recurrence of toxicity does happen. So people do need further doses after the initial naloxone has worn off, and even kind of an infusion where they're getting it kind of overnight. So it is really important to seek medical help after an overdose, because there definitely is that chance of recurrence of toxicity. And sometimes it might not be as obvious as normal, because it's this prolonged slowed breathing, but maybe the level of consciousness, kind of they might be more awake and not kind of not so sleepy, but the breathing still may be kind of lower than normal, and that is a concern. So that is a key message that we try to get out there. And then finally, to finish up on my last slide there, just putting into context around kind of all opioid-related hospitalizations, it is still only a very small proportion of opioid-related hospitalizations. So we do need to think of this holistically as an approach to kind of opioid overdose. And not just focus on kind of nitazenes. I know this talk's on nitazenes, but do think of it in terms of the overall opioid overdose management approach. And I just recall that I forgot to mention something that we're just working on at the moment relating to a new kind of group of people who are presenting to for withdrawal management. So we do have a group of people who are becoming dependent on nitazenes as well, and kind of either intentionally seeking them out, or kind of or potentially think not necessarily realizing at first, but after some time realized that it was an opioid, and then became dependent and needing kind of complex withdrawal management in hospitals. So and that's people who are using vape refillable kind of vape products. So that's a new thing that hasn't been described kind of elsewhere, and something that we're actively working on in New South Wales right now.
That was Jared Brown, Manager of Toxicity Response, Epidemiology and Surveillance at the Centre for Alcohol and Other Drugs in the New South Wales Ministry of Health in Australia, speaking on a webinar hosted by the New South Wales Users and AIDS Association entitled Navigating Nitazenes. We'll hear more in a moment. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Let's hear more.
Back many, many decades ago, essentially, they did all the free kind of marketing testing that they did back then, and they kind of decided it wasn't a viable product to continue because the kind of the dose, the therapeutic window, which is what we call in terms of the relative dose to what's safe to get the therapeutic effects in terms of pain relief versus kind of the toxicity, it was just too difficult to manage medically. I am not aware of that. There might be kind of but recent developments that pharma companies are doing it, but not publicly that we're aware of. So in terms of differences, they're not particularly different to any to other opioid overdoses. So that's kind of part of the challenge in kind of monitoring this. There is, like, because some respond to kind of your stock standard dosing and naloxone that ED clinicians will give, but some of the cases are needing a little bit more, and the ongoing doses. So that's kind of the kind of trigger that makes us think maybe that's a nitazene related presentation. Often, actually, it ends up being co-ingested benzodiazepines, like fake Xanax with bromazolam in it, that actually ends up being the plus heroin, and that's actually what's causing the prolonged sedation. So there's a big mix, but in terms of how they present, it's kind of typical opioid overdose kind of effects that people would have in terms of kind of decreased level of consciousness and kind of decreased breathing rate, kind of pinpoint pupils, and by the time they come into hospital, a lot of the kind of resuscitation type stuff's happened in terms of naloxone and oxygenation. So in hospital, it's mostly about potentially needing to give further doses of naloxone as that first dose kind of wears off in the first hour. Like the fentanyl crisis, for example, in the US has been going on for many years, and that never really reached Australia. We did see some fentanyl analogs a few years ago in Australia, and they kind of seem to have gone away. But that seemed to be confined to New South Wales. There were very few detections outside of New South Wales, but it may be because of the different monitoring systems. It's hard to know. But the nitazenes within does seem to be increasing of late. The theory, obviously worldwide, that applies more to the European market is because of the cultivation ban of opium poppies in Afghanistan, and that's what's driving the nitazene market, particularly in Europe, where Afghanistan supplies the majority of heroin to Europe. Australia's kind of supplies through Southeast Asia predominantly, so it's less likely to be that, but and the heroin supply is still available in Australia. But that's kind of part of the worldwide reason for kind of nitazene development. In terms of why it's reaching Australia, I can't necessarily comment too much on that, but that's some of the background reasons of what might be driving it. We've been kind of relatively resilient with the fentanyl kind of issue within Australia, and that may well be the case this time as well. The fact that we're detecting more nitazenes now is potentially, compared to kind of when fentanyls were around a few years ago, maybe just monitoring systems have become more robust, and that has allowed us to detect more cases. So it is always hard to know whether we're just detecting more things now, but it's something we, in terms of preparedness, opioid overdose kind of harm reduction and prevention is something just generally we need. We do, and we need to continue, because the risk will be there regardless of what the source, whether it's pharmaceutical opioids, heroin, or kind of synthetic opioids. So the the initial person who presented for kind of withdrawal management, they described kind of an unusual history that made the clinician kind of think that this didn't quite sound like kind of what they initially described, where they said that it was a kind of THC kind of type vape, but then they were like, oh, maybe it's actually something else. So that triggered the testing of the vape, as well as the client who was being managed also submitted kind of some kind of blood and urine samples to be analyzed as well. So kind of it's been kind of confirmed in multiple kind of people from that emerging kind of presentations that multiple people have had their refill liquid as well as kind of their blood and or urine tested for that. No, the signs of withdrawal are the same as other opioids. But the management is not quite the same as kind of heroin in terms of the pharmacotherapy, the medicines that the doctor will use to treat it may need to be tailored differently because of how potent they are. So to get the equivalent kind of doses into the system to stop those withdrawal effects, that's where the variability is mostly, not in the actual withdrawal effects. So the typical opioid type withdrawal effects will be the same as any other opioid. In a powder form, it technically is like a yellowish kind of brownish color. So if you had the pure powder, but once it's kind of mixed with fillers, once it's kind of got dyes in it, like the Red Bull ecstasy tablets, once it's put into a liquid, you can color it whatever. So we've had every color under the sun. But if you get a yellowish powder, it would definitely raise my concerns that that is potentially a nitazine, but it can be a white powder. It can be anything, just depending on how it's mixed together. In relation to the naloxone management for kind of people who are resistant, like I think it's so great that kind of working with the community to try and kind of recognize the need to kind of seek help. One of the things with naloxone, so the nasal spray is kind of quite short acting, but the intramuscular, the Pranoxad, is longer lasting because it's kind of slowly releases in through the muscles. So if you do have people who are kind of potentially less likely to kind of seek medical care or might then be on their own or something, the intramuscular form does offer a longer lasting effect. So just wanting to bring out that in the discussion so that the attendees are aware as well.
That was Jared Brown, Manager of Toxicity Response, Epidemiology and Surveillance at the Centre for Alcohol and Other Drugs in the New South Wales Ministry of Health in Australia, speaking on a webinar hosted by the New South Wales Users and AIDS Association entitled Navigating Nitazines. Let's hear more. Stephanie Hawking is the Director of Clinical Services and Programs at the Centre for Alcohol and Other Drugs in the New South Wales Ministry of Health.
One of the most alarming things that we've seen quite recently was in a detox in southwestern Sydney, where there were a couple of presentations of very young people who were vaping, thinking that it was vape with THC in it. And they'd been doing it for a few years. And it turned out that it was nitazines. So that in itself was really concerning. So we're looking at approaches there to how to access that community. And it is concerning for the greater community, but also those micro communities, especially the multicultural communities that wouldn't usually access health services in the way that the general community does. So we're looking at strategies there. With that response, I think Jared brushed on it earlier, we got together looking at nitazine detox and just how much medication is required and the approach that's required for someone who's detoxing off nitazines. We did find, or Southwestern Sydney found, with those young people that the regular opioid-related detox regimes weren't working. So we got a group of experts together, including people from Southwestern Sydney, or the medical people from Southwestern Sydney who worked with these people, and we've developed a consensus document. That's in the final stages at the moment. So once that's finalised, we'll be looking at disseminating that to clinicians across the state. We're looking at expanding take-home naloxone. We are in the process at the moment of looking at having take-home naloxone in EDs. We've been working on that for quite some time. We're also looking at Aboriginal community-controlled organisations. The future of naloxone, we are looking at ways to get it out there as far and wide as we can. We've recently looked at policy and some instruments to ensure that workers can, first aid trained workers can administer naloxone, which, you know, when we're looking at, you know, security guards and you know, first responders, et cetera, that could have a really huge impact. We're looking at that, of course, we looked at the medical response. We're looking at the psychosocial response, especially when we're looking at quite young people. We're looking at, you know, we're in the process of pulling together a team of people that will consist of peers, of course, community leaders, religious leaders, experts in the field to try and look at the psychosocial response and how we can get our comms and support out there as far and wide as we possibly can. I think the really important message here is for us all to be alert but not alarmed. At the moment, we're not seeing it as a huge issue, and we need to not keep our eye on the ball of substance use and responding to substance use and supporting people who use substances in whatever way they need. So I think that, like I said, is the most important thing. I think getting education out as far and wide, getting looking at our comms strategy and how we can access far and wide. I think Rochelle brushed on it earlier and the trends that the harm reduction space is seeing, how we support the harm reduction space. We're looking at things like, you know, preparedness simulations within health and just sort of seeing worst case scenario, what we need to do, ensuring that response is in place so that we can respond if we need to. Hopefully we will not need to should there be mass casualties. I think the challenge right now is that it's not huge, but it is quite concerning having very young people who are opioid naive and have been using for some time. And those reports are not just one or two people. We've had reports. Now, this is hearsay because we've not seen this, but that the issue is far greater than those couple of young people that we're seeing. So that's why we really want to access that community specifically. So basically the message is we need to remain vigilant and continue to get that message out of Take Home Naloxone. Also, you know, for our peers, people who use substances, you know, start low, go slow, that over and over again, we just need to reinforce that.
That was Stephanie Hawking, Director of Clinical Services and Programs at the Centre for Alcohol and Other Drugs in the New South Wales Ministry of Health in Australia, speaking on a webinar hosted by the New South Wales Users and AIDS Association entitled Navigating Nitazenes. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Century of Lies is a volunteer production for community radio and syndicated via the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network's Audio Port service. Find this edition of Century along with an archive of past shows at the Drug Truth Network website, drugtruth.net. You'll find a link there to subscribe to the Century of Lies podcast. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy and the failed war on drugs. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long.
So long.
For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.